from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the Sisters of Mercy celebrate their long history in Sacramento. Five nuns arrived in Sacramento 150 years ago tomorrow. Also, One Book Sacramento returns this year. It's a celebration of reading lasting 1 month. This year's festivities focus on the book The Suspect by local best-selling novelist John Lesqua. First, Ted Koppel's new documentary is about overcrowding in California prisons. He focuses on the state prison in Vacaville, where he observed life and talked with staff and inmates for about a week. The documentary, called Breaking Point, premieres Sunday on Discovery. Ted Koppel joined me this morning via a studio at NPR, and I asked him why he chose Vacaville.
Because the situation in California is about as bad in terms of overcrowding as it is anywhere in the country, and the folks at Vacaville were exceedingly cooperative and couldn't have been nicer about having us in and giving us total access to the prison.
Is California State Prison Solano, as the full name of the prison in Vacaville is it unusually crowded?
No, it's just, well, it is unusually crowded, but it's not unusual for California. You've got a prison system that was designed to hold no more than 100,000 inmates, and it's now holding 173,000. The prison, Solano is just as overcrowded, on a much smaller scale. I think the prison was designed to hold about 2,500, as I recall, and it now holds about 6,000.
My goodness. So what does that mean for daily life there for both the inmates and the staff?
Well, I mean, one of the things I must confess, Jeffrey, that surprised me about the place is that while they bristle at the notion that it is segregated, it is. It's not segregated in terms of keeping the races apart on the exercise yard or not having blacks, whites, Hispanics in the same cell block together. But within the cell block, everything is very rigidly segregated. The recreation tables, you got a black table, a Hispanic table, a white table. A white had better not sit at the black table, a black had better not sit at the Hispanic table. The beds are lined up three high, triple tier in this old gymnasium, and certain corridors are only meant for the black inmates, certain corridors only meant for the white inmates. You go out of your neighborhood at risk of your personal safety, and that is made very clear. And the administration, the prison administration, knows full well that people are in there and are hanging according to their gang affiliation. And they not only permit that to happen, they encourage it because it's one of the few ways that they can really maintain any kind of order, given the fact that there is so much undercrowding and that there are too few correctional officers.
Is that something that the officers told you, or is that your observation, the segregation?
Both. Both.
Yes.
No, both. I mean, the officers at the end of this converted gym, they've got a chart up there, a color-coded chart showing, you know, which are the white beds, which are the black beds, which are the Hispanic beds.
Goodness. My guest is Ted Koppel. His latest production is Breaking Point, a documentary for the Discovery Channel about overcrowding in California prisons. It premieres on Sunday, and it focuses on the state prison in Vacaville. Could you tell us a bit more about one of the inmates you talked to, a bit about that person, what you learned about that person, and about how he experiences life at the prison in Vacaville?
Well, I mean, there's one very charming younger man. I mean, he's younger. It's all a question of perspective. From where I am, he's younger. I guess he's about 40. And he's been in and out of prison a lot. The last time that he was paroled, he lasted less than a day before he got into a bar fight and got into trouble again and ended up back in prison. He has been paroled yet again. One of the curiosities of state law in California is that when a man is paroled, he has to go back to the community where he committed the crime in the first place. In Travis's case, this is a community where there are no jobs. His license has been suspended, so he doesn't have a car. In order to get to the nearest large community where he might be able to find a job, he has to take a bus. The first bus doesn't leave until 7:45 in the morning. So as he says, it's an hour and a half away. who's going to give me a job when I say, well, I can only be here at 9:45? You know, I can't make it before 9:45. In a sense, the system is almost designed to force these people to fail in their effort to stay on the outside.
And could you give us an example of a staff person that you talked with, just a flavor of who that person is and what life is like for them working in the prison in Vacaville?
Well, there's a wonderful man whose first name is Saul, who has been a correctional officer himself, who now, he's been in there, I guess, 28 years. He's been an officer at within the prison system. A very sensible man, a very decent man who is trying hard to make the most with the money that he's got there. But as he points out, it costs an enormous amount of money to engage in any kind of vocational training. And so essentially, out of all the prisoners they've got in there, 12% either make it into vocational training or a high school equivalency diploma, anger management classes, alcohol or drug rehabilitation programs. Out of all the prisoners in there, 12% make it into one or more of those programs. And he is trying as hard as anyone can to give these men a chance to improve their lot and to make sure that when they get out, they'll be better equipped to handle life on the outside than they were before. But he is fighting such an uphill battle that he knows that the chances of success are minimal.
I'm sure there are some people who say, well, that's just too bad for the prisoners. They committed a crime. If they have to bunk up 2, 3, 4 to a cell, well, that's their problem. And you know, why do they need to go to classes and have programs? Why should people on the outside care about whether or not conditions are unusually tough and overcrowded in California prisons?
Well, you've put your finger on the main problem, Jeffrey. That's it. That's exactly how many, if not most, people respond. And I would say, while it's not the most humane point of view, I can understand that point of view and might even agree with it, except 90% of these men and women are coming out again, coming to a neighborhood near you. And the only thing that they have improved is their facility at crime. The one classroom that is always available is the classroom that these criminals teach one another. And where it comes to making these men and women who will be coming out of prison again one of these days and who do end up going back to their old neighborhoods, you know, I would think that society at large would understand that teaching these people a trade which they can actually practice on the outside, a trade which will enable them to get a job, make money, pay taxes, take care of their families, not fall back into a life of crime again, that it doesn't take too much for people to understand that that is to the advantage of society at large. Forget about doing something nice for criminals. Unfortunately, in our political system, nobody ever gets elected by saying, what we need is more rehabilitation. People get elected by playing precisely to those prejudices and saying, who cares? Lock them up, throw away the key, I don't care, warehouse them, stack them 5 high for all I care. I understand where those feelings are coming from, but it's a very short-sighted point of view.
Ted Koppel's latest production is Breaking Point. It's a documentary for the Discovery Channel about overcrowding in California prisons, and it premieres on Sunday, October 7th. You can only get into a prison with the cooperation of the correctional department, and you can only stay safe inside the prison with the cooperation of the department. How do you know, when you're preparing to do a program like this and once you're there, how do you know that you're going to be able to do your job properly and find out what's really going on?
Oh, I mean, you know, do I think that I've uncovered every deep, dark secret of the prison at Solano? Do I ever expect when I go to a prison that I'm going to know everything that's going on? Of course not. I mean, first of all, I wasn't there long enough to do that. My colleagues went there several times over a period of months. I was there over a period of about a week. And I certainly don't expect to know everything that is going on, but I think I know more now than I did before I went in, and I think that the viewers are going to learn a little bit something about the prison system that could be useful to them. This is a national problem, Jeffrey. We have 2.2 million prisoners in this country. We have more men and women behind bars in this country than any other country in the world. We have four times as many prisoners today as we did 25 years ago. There's something wrong with that equation, and I would think if people think about it in as dispassionate a way as they can, they will realize that sooner or later we're going to have to change some of the things we're doing. And if we don't, the federal courts have already ordered the state of California to relieve the overcrowding problem. If they don't find a better way of doing it, the courts are going to step in and just say, release 10% of your prisoners. You decide who goes and who stays. Or release 15 or 20% of your prisoners. There are more sensible ways of going about this process of alleviating the overcrowding conditions. And there are more sensible ways of dealing with prisoners so that when they come out, believe me, even if you can go to school, even if you get anger management classes, even if you get the best vocational training, being in prison is no picnic. I have been to many, many prisons over the years. There has never been a place where I would voluntarily spend even a month, let alone 10 or 15 or 20 years. And this notion of these country club prisons, it just doesn't gel with reality. It really doesn't. It is a punishment to be in one of those places, but it is to all of our advantage that these men and women be given some opportunity to improve themselves so that when they come out, they won't be such a drain on society as a whole.
When you look at what's happening in California prisons, the parts that are being run now effectively by federal judges, it's very expensive. Part of the solution is spending a lot more money than California has in the past. And yet California has big budget problems, as do many other states. How on earth can we solve this without unlimited money?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the voters of California have painted themselves into a box. 40% of the people who are in prison right now are there because of the three strikes and you're out laws that were passed back in the early mid-90s. Those laws, I understand, were designed because the public of California was outraged, in particular over the Polly Klass murder, but in general over violent crimes and the fact that violent criminals were being paroled and then committing violent crimes again. The irony is that so many of the people who are in prison now are there because the three strikes and you're out laws give no flexibility to the judges, and men and women are being sent away for very, very long terms, even when they have not committed violent crimes. So I think one of the ways of sort of adjusting and finding a way out of the problem is to say, you know something, the violent criminals, yes. The nonviolent ones, maybe this is not the best way of dealing with them.
In addition to your work with the Discovery Channel, you also do commentaries for NPR. Do those commentaries allow you to say things, to maybe even go out on a limb in a way that you might not have felt comfortable doing when you were the anchor of Nightline on ABC?
Absolutely. I mean, what I do for NPR is I'm a senior news analyst, and so I get to analyze. When I was the anchor of Nightline at ABC, I was expected to maintain a more objective posture, and I tried very hard over 25 years to do that. I love working for and with NPR. I think it's an extraordinary outfit and the one organization these days that just continues to prove that quality programming actually can draw a large audience, and that's awfully good news.
Do you watch Nightline?
On occasion.
And what do you think about how the program has evolved? It's changed quite a bit since you left.
It has, and I'd be lying if I said that was the way I would have done it, but I did it my way for 25 years, and now they're doing it a different way, and they seem to be succeeding at it, so I'm happy for them. I'm just glad that Nightline continues to be a presence on network television.
And how do you feel about the state of network news? There's been a lot of turnover in recent years, a lot of well-known names, including Ted Koppel, of course, but others too, who've moved on from high-profile anchor positions. There's been a real turnover. What do you think about the state of network TV news today?
Well, I think it has less to do with the turnover. I mean, I'm old enough to remember what it was like when Dan Rather took over from Walter Cronkite, and when Tom took over from who would have been Jack Chancellor, I guess, in the old days when Tom Brokaw took over from him and Peter Jennings took over from Frank Reynolds. And you know something? At that time, everyone was going around saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. These kids are taking over from the old traditional anchor people. And you know something? Rather and Brokaw and Jennings ended up doing rather well. And I have far less concern about the men and women who have taken over today than I do about the overall economic pressures that are forcing television news to move in more frivolous directions than I think is healthy.
Ted Koppel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Not at all, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure. Thanks very much. It's always good to hear a good Scots accent there.
Thank you.
Take care.
Ted Koppel's documentary Breaking Point premieres this Sunday on the Discovery Channel. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we'll remember the long history of the Sisters of Mercy in Sacramento. They arrived in Sacramento on October 2nd, 1857. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow in Insight, a new play about Edgar Allan Poe getting its world premiere in Nevada City. It offers a glimpse into Poe's work and personal life before he died in 1849. You'll meet the local playwright behind Evermore and a couple of cast members who'll also perform a scene. On October 2nd, 1857, a boat pulled up at Sacramento's Front Street. On board was a small group of nuns from the Sisters of Mercy. They wanted to alleviate some of the squalor of Gold Rush Sacramento. 150 years on, the Sisters of Mercy are still active here, and they're celebrating their big anniversary. Joining me are two local members of the Sisters of Mercy, their local president, Sister Sheila Brown, and their historian, Sister Catherine Doyle. Sisters, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Sister Sheila, when we think of the Sisters of Mercy in Sacramento, I think most people think first of the hospitals, the healthcare mission, but that wasn't actually why that first group of nuns came to Sacramento. Why did they come?
That's right. The invitation really was to start a school in Sacramento. So education was their primary reason for coming from San Francisco. And of course, when they got here, they realized that there were a lot of sick people and as Mercy always responds to need, we got involved with the healthcare ministry.
Sister Catherine, give us a quick idea of what the sisters would have seen in Sacramento when they arrived in their boat.
Oh, it would have been a very different town than what we're used to. There were no levees downtown, and of course, Sacramento was much lower, as you know, in the 1860s after a huge flood. The city was lifted up, so to speak, 15 feet. So when the sisters got here, it would have been marshy down there. And, of course, the town hadn't totally developed yet. So much of it was business-oriented because it was the gateway to the mines. And when the sisters came, not only did they devote themselves to education, but they also devoted themselves to taking care of orphans, which were often the result of mining accidents or the disease of the time.
I imagine it must have been a little chaotic in Sacramento at that time. What did the nuns do when they arrived? Did they have a plan or did they just show up and figure that they'd get something going?
Well, they probably had a plan, but, you know, circumstances in time always upset plans. They were going to open a school, and they literally did 3 days after they arrived. And they had 60 students on the first day of school, but by the end of that semester, they had 120, so they hadn't quite planned on that many. They started out in a basement school, but Sacramento floods, so they had to find new property because they couldn't accommodate all their students. So things just kept changing as circumstances changed.
Were there many places for kids to go to school at that time before the sisters arrived?
There were. There were actually other small schools, and they were peppered, you know, through that area, and many of them were, at that time, one-room schoolhouses, of course. Mm. Some of them were not long term. They would only last maybe as long as they had a schoolmaster or a schoolmistress.
Yeah. The Sisters of Mercy are celebrating their 150th anniversary in Sacramento. A group of nuns arrived here on October 2nd, 1857. My guests are Sister Catherine Doyle, who's a historian of the Sisters of Mercy in California, and Sister Sheila Brown, who's the president of the Sisters of Mercy's Auburn Regional Community. Sister Sheila, soon after the Sisters of Mercy arrived in Sacramento, they got hold of some property in what turned out to be a fairly important location downtown, and they lost it. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Mother Baptist Russell secured what she thought was a perfect location for a school in the late 1850s. But when the Capitol Bill was passed in the early 1860s, the property was claimed by eminent domain and for the present site of the state capitol. And so it was very important for us to sort of revisit that site as we celebrate our 150th. So yesterday, actually Saturday, we established a beautiful sculpture of Baptist Russell on that present, on the site of our original property.
Sister Catherine, how did the sisters react when their property was taken away from them? Do we know?
Well, you know, they're always very understated, so we don't really know exactly how they felt. But land prices in Sacramento and in California were very inflated. And so the property we actually had to buy after losing that land mm-hmm. was double the price of the original land.
Oh, wow.
And so
that
made it quite
sweetens the loss a little, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it certainly does. And it wasn't as good a location in the sense that when Sacramentans lifted up the town, the waters then ran off into the new property. So I'm sure there was a certain amount of disappointment at losing what was really an ideal location.
Around that time, too, there was a huge flood in Sacramento, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. It actually kind of borders 2 years. It started in December of 1860, and Sacramento was inundated. And then there was a second flooding in January of 1861. So we have stories of the sisters teaching at St. Joseph's, which would have been on 9th and G at the time. And they were. It was a sunny day, similar to today, and the farmers started running in to grab their daughters, and the sisters could not understand what was going on because there wasn't a scrap of rain. But the river, literally, the waters just rushed down the river is what happened. And Sacramento was inundated with water, and actually parts of it were still wet after 6 months.
Oh, my goodness.
So the sisters stayed in Sacramento during that time, and we have these wonderful stories of the men of the city rowing the boats to our second story balcony.
Rowing up to the second story.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
Goodness.
So the sisters could climb over the balconies, get in the boats, and be rowed over to what they called the pavilion, where they could nurse the flood victims during that time. And then when they were finished with their work for the day, the men rowed them back and they went over the balconies again.
Now, when I look at pictures of the Sisters of Mercy from those days, Sister Sheila, they were wearing the traditional nuns' garments, the black mm-hmm. garments, heavy. They look heavy clothes. Nowadays, the Sisters of Mercy wear, quote-unquote, regular clothes. What must it have been like, do you think, to have been working in Sacramento in the heat with the floods and so on and wearing clothes like that?
I can only imagine, having never worn that garb. We had a little taste of it during the Gold Rush days this past Labor Day weekend when many of our sisters dressed up in the garb, and we had the hottest weekend of the year. It was 104 degrees, and they were in the Eagle Theater doing little vignettes with no air conditioning. So I think the garb that they wore, though, in those days was more like the garb that women wore at the time, you know. And then as time went on, they continued to wear it until probably about 40 years ago. I think Catherine Macaulay's original vision was that we would be more like the people, dress and look like the people that we minister with.
Catherine Macaulay was the Irish woman who founded the order
right.
in Ireland back in, what, the late 1700s?
1831.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sister Catherine, when did the Sisters of Mercy really get into the health care, into hospitals, I guess?
Well, originally, when we came to California in 1854, we came as teachers. However, the day we arrived, 2 days before that, another community, the Presentation Sisters, had opened the school. So our tradition is always to respond to the area of greatest need, and in San Francisco at that time, it was healthcare. So literally, the first week we arrived, we got into the healthcare ministry by going out to the sick in their homes. And then they also, in San Francisco, they did the ministry to the sick in the county hospital. And they got the contract, actually, from the county at that time to care for the sick. But the county then went bankrupt and never paid any bills, so to speak. So we built the first Catholic hospital in San Francisco. So when we came up here, Sacramento had lots of doctors because of the gold rush. And it did have some private sanitariums. It had no surgical provision or anything like that. So it was about 30 years after we arrived in Sacramento that we went into the healthcare ministry here at the request of the doctors. But we were already active in that in San Francisco.
Because the doctors wanted the sisters involved because there weren't enough nurses?
Well, there were some nurses, but they recognized that they needed a circle of women who were committed to that ministry. It was hard work. You know, our first hospital over on 23rd and R was 3 stories high. And, of course, everything had to be carried up 3 flights of stairs, you know, patients, beds, equipment, food, you name it, and down. So it was very heavy physical labor for the nurses, plus so many of the conveniences we equate with healthcare today just were not there.
Sister Sheila, that first hospital at 23rd and R, if I'm not mistaken, that's very close to where the Sacramento Bee is today.
Yes, the present site of the Sacramento Bee, actually, yes.
Well, when did the sisters first create their something that we would call a hospital by today's standards? Or would that 23rd and R be considered a hospital?
Yes, it would be. Initially, we bought Ridge Home in 1896. But it was very small, and it didn't have any provision for surgery or some of that kind of thing. So the next year, we built Mater Misericordia, which the Sacramentans couldn't pronounce it, so they called it the Sisters' Hospital. It's still hard to pronounce. That was expanded 3 times in 15 years. And so by the time it reached, you know, the second expansion, it was fully equipped according to the standards of the time.
Sister Sheila, how involved are the Sisters of Mercy, the nuns, in the running of the hospitals today?
Well, we're involved more in the governance area. That's one area. We serve on boards. We do have a number of sisters that are still ministering in our hospitals, mostly in the area of mission integration and spiritual care. We believe that we want to collaborate with our lay partners. And probably the last 30 to 35 years, a lot of the administrative positions are assumed by our lay partners. But the sisters are very present, very involved, and we believe that we are able to influence the direction of our healthcare ministry and ensure that the mission and the values are adhered to. But it's done in conjunction and collaboration with numerous co-workers and volunteers.
The local sisters live, or at least most of them do, I guess, in Auburn. Is that correct?
Actually, no. We have about 25 people that live in Auburn. We have a lot of sisters that live here locally in Sacramento. And then up in the North State, where we also sponsor 3 hospitals, we have sisters living up in the North State, and then others out of state as well.
Sister Catherine, is there any way to guess what Mary Baptist Russell would have made of the Sisters of Mercy today in the Sacramento area? Do you think that what you're doing today is in line with what she would have, if she could have imagined it?
Well, I think so, because when I entered, I've been a sister now for 45 years, and when I entered, we were primarily teachers and nurses. And today, that's simply not true. We're in such a variety of venues. Whether that is working in homeless shelters or whether it's working with battered women or in the parishes or Mercy housing, those kinds of things. And when you go back and look at Mary Baptist, basically what she did was she responded to needs as they came to her. So she had an employment agency, and she had housing for people who needed it. So I think we're very much in line with what her desire was. And she did the same things that we do today, in the sense that very early on, we never had enough sisters. I don't think, even at the turn of the century, we only had 20 sisters here in Sacramento altogether doing all sorts of things. So we've always collaborated with other folks, even just starting nursing schools, things like that, when we didn't have enough nurses.
Sister Sheila, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think Mercy really is responding to needs. And as the needs change, then our response also change. Our mission stays the same, but the way we express our ministry can differ, because the needs are some are similar to 150 years ago, but there have been a lot of new needs in our city and its surrounding areas. But I believe that we have been very true to the mission of both Catherine McCauley and Baptist Russell and their vision.
We're talking about the Sisters of Mercy. 150 years ago tomorrow, a small group of nuns led by Mary Baptist arrived in Sacramento and set up shop, basically, and the Sisters of Mercy are still very active in the Sacramento area. And my guests are Sister Sheila Brown, is president of the Sisters of Mercy's Auburn Regional Community. Sister Catherine Doyle is their historian. Now, you brought a fine-looking object. It looks like a tile with paint on it. Explain it to us, Sister Catherine.
Well, we brought what's called a mission tile with us, and it's a wonderful example of the way that the sisters used the things around them for education. And Mother Baptist herself was a great historian in her own right, and these were collected during the time that the California missions were secularized. So she knew they were falling into disrepair, so she collected as many tiles from the original mission chain of California as she could. And she had her students then paint the original mission from which the tile is taken on them. So they're like oil paintings now. And she collected an entire exhibit of these. And then she sent one exhibit to the Catholic University of America that was just opening. And the other one she had in San Francisco, but it was destroyed in the 1906 earthquake. So as part of our 150th anniversary, Catholic University sent them back to us. And they're a collection of 18 different mission tiles all throughout California. Each one, she even had the seal of authenticity put on them. And you can see the names of the student artists. It's just a wonderful set. But I think it was so true to her that she wanted to preserve the California history as well as the religious dimension of our education.
You can see a couple of photographs of this tile on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, if you can't go online right now. The tile is basically about 2 feet. It's quite big. It's about 2 feet long and about maybe up to a foot wide at the widest point, and it's painted mainly green. These are going to be on display in a couple of local museums, aren't they?
They are currently at the Discovery Museum. You'll see some of them there. And also we have two of them, I think, or one, at the Library Galleria, which will be there until November.
Sister Sheila, as we wrap this up, your thoughts about how the Sisters of Mercy are, what's the state of the Sisters of Mercy today in Northern California, and how do you see the future? What's coming up?
I believe, I personally have a lot of hope in the future for the Sisters of Mercy and for the Works of Mercy. We are very, very committed to continuing to meet the needs of the greater Sacramento area, in fact, the whole Northern California area. We are committed to promoting and nurturing vocations, welcoming new members into our community. I think we have a future full of hope, which I'm excited about, and I think this 150th celebration has been a time of renewal and recommitment for us as Sisters of Mercy, and I think for our co-workers and our Mercy Associates and volunteers as well.
Really? So people are really reflecting on this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We had about 1,200 people at our celebration on Saturday, and people were just re-energized and had just for our mission and our ministries.
That's a lot of people.
It is. And I think it's like Sister Sheila is saying, it's really not about us. It's mm-hmm. about the Mercy mission that everybody is involved in, whether you're a partner or a co-worker. And I think that's what we're really celebrating, more than just the sisters. It's mm-hmm. the wonderful outlay that everybody does to reach out to those in need.
That was our original vision, you know, that it wouldn't be just about mm-hmm. us. It would be to celebrate really the works of mercy and all the people that have been part of that for the last 150 years.
I can understand the modesty, but nevertheless, congratulations to the Sisters of Mercy for being here for so long in Sacramento. There aren't many institutions that have been here longer in Sacramento. It's the 150th anniversary tomorrow morning of the Sisters of Mercy in Sacramento. My guests, Sister Sheila Brown, president of the Sisters of Mercy's Auburn Regional Community, and Sister Catherine Doyle, historian of the Sisters of Mercy in California. Thank you both very much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, it's One Book Sacramento again, when one book is promoted as a reading opportunity for people in the Sacramento area. This year's book is The Suspect by local best-selling novelist John Lesqua. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tell us what you think about Insight or send us suggestions. Our email address is insight@capradio.org. This year's One Book Sacramento starts today. It's a month-long focus on one book organized by the Sacramento Public Library. This year's book is The Suspect by John Lesqua, the local best-selling novelist. John has several reading events scheduled this month in Sacramento. Still, other events are being organized at library branches. And we'll also get the results of a mystery writers contest that's been organized in conjunction with this year's One Book Sacramento. On the phone is John Lesqua. John, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, it's great to be back, Jeff.
Well, what did you think when you heard that The Suspect had been chosen for this year's One Book Sacramento?
I was totally stunned and extremely pleased. You know, I mean, the last two books, Mas Masumoto's book and Maxine Kingston's book, were very different types of book from The Suspect. And it really surprised me that the libraries thought enough about my work and the kind of work I do to make me the next selection. It was great.
And what did they say they'd like you to do, to bring to it? What did they say why they had chosen The Suspect?
Well, they think it is full of, and this also pleases me to death, but they think it's full of kind of relevant themes, even though it's a mystery book. You know, as you know, we've talked a lot before. My books try to bring in a lot of kind of current, not just current events, but themes that are echoing in society. And I think that it's really neat that the Library Association recognized that and called this book the one.
John Lesqua, novelist, is the author of The Suspect, the featured book in this year's One Book Sacramento. Also with us on the phone is Anne Marie Gold, who's director of Sacramento Public Library. Anne Marie, welcome back to Insight.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us why you chose The Suspect for One Book Sacramento this year.
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons that we chose John's wonderful book. First of all, it's about John as a wonderful Sacramento author. As you may know, we are also celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Sacramento Public Library this year, and we wanted to highlight a Sacramento author this year. John certainly is one of the best-known Sacramento authors, and so it was a wonderful opportunity to bring together a well-known author and also recognize somebody from Sacramento at that time. In addition to that, you know, John really has had a wonderful period of writing great novels, and I think more and more we're finding that our readers in Sacramento really enjoy his work, and so we knew that they would enjoy being able to read his latest one, The Suspect, this year.
Remind us, please, what The Suspect is about.
The Suspect is a mystery story. It's a story that follows the case of a man who is accused of killing his wife. And the reason I picked this is because this is kind of the most common eventuality that happens in a murder trial, the first person to come under suspicion is tends to be the spouse or the live-in, you know, partner of the victim. And, the tendency is to make that a cliche, and I've had it be a cliche in some of my books in the past. But I thought it'd be interesting to take this and make it really distinctive and make it really not a cliche, make it something that seemed to be rational and reasonable in this way. And the other cool thing I think about the suspect is it's the first time that I've used a female protagonist. So I've got a woman lawyer named Gina Roque who gets the case early on, and I think a lot of the things that happened to her in this book are pretty exciting and pretty interesting.
Now, the Sacramento Public Library, of course, serves everyone, at least in theory, is open to everyone. But, John, when you wrote The Suspect, what kind of audience did you have in mind?
Well, you know, Jeffrey, what I like to think of as my audience is pretty mixed between male and female, probably college-educated. Generally speaking, I would say they're fairly intelligent people. I don't write stupid books, and I think that people who read them like the puzzle and like trying to figure out the puzzle, and they also appreciate the language.
Well, Anne-Marie, let's develop this idea. Mm-hmm. When you're choosing a book for One Book Sacramento, what kind of audience are you keeping in mind? Because it's impossible for any one book, or I shouldn't say impossible, but very hard for any one book to work for all kinds of people.
You're absolutely right about that, Jeffrey. We certainly serve a very broad range of readers in the Sacramento area. And as you mentioned earlier, we've had a variety of different books that we've chosen. So frankly, what we tend to look for is a book that will have some broad-based appeal in its topic or in its setting or in the currency of what it's talking about. And I really think The Suspect, which I really enjoyed, and John, I loved your female protagonist.
Thank you.
really brings a lot of that together. You know, the opening section where the husband is at Echo Lake, I think a lot of people here in the Sacramento area would identify immediately with where he was, and then the drive down back to the Bay Area. There was a lot of kind of local sense to this book also.
The Suspect, the novel by John Lacroix, is this year's featured book in One Book Sacramento. It's a month-long event where people are encouraged to read one book, and this year, of course, it's The Suspect, and lots of events are tied in with it. John Lacroix, the novelist, is on the phone, as is Anne-Marie Gold, the director of Sacramento Public Library. Anne-Marie, tell us what exactly you're hoping people will do with The Suspect in One Book Sacramento.
Things that we do is we encourage people throughout the community to read the book. If you're in a book club, make this your October book club book. Be able to attend some of the events that John is going to be at this month, this Thursday evening at 6 o'clock at the Galleria at the Central Library. John is going to be the speaker for the Bee Book Club. We also have additional events with him, including at our 150th anniversary celebration on Sunday, October 21st. John is going to be announcing the winner of the Friends of the Library Mystery Writers Contest. So lots of opportunities to interact with John, read the book, enjoy the setting of it, enjoy the characters, and really make it part of your life in Sacramento this month.
John, what are you hoping will happen in association with The Suspect this month, not just at your events, but in general?
Well, first, I must say, this is more exciting than it probably sounds on the radio, but it's just a terrific opportunity to get in front of a whole bunch of people and talk about this stuff that is what I make my life out of and that I try to write books about. And I invite everybody to come out, and I know I have a lot of readers here, and it's wonderful, and I'd love to have them all come out and, you know, read the books and this book particularly and feel like there's not a wall between me and them or really any of the writers in this area. This is a great town for writers and authors and getting in front of people and sharing what they can do.
Anne-Marie, tell us about the Mystery Writers Contest. I guess this was devised because of the kind of book that The Suspect is.
Yes, it is. Our friends at the library for a number of years have had a a wonderful writers contest, and this year they decided to make it into a mystery writers contest. And it's an opportunity for people who are budding mystery writers to submit an outline for what they'd like to write about, and it's being judged, and John will announce the winners on October 21st.
It's going to be very cool, I have to say.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
The deadline, we should note, has already passed.
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. All of the materials have been submitted already.
And how are you going through all of this material?
I believe that the Friends of the Library have gotten a number of professional readers to take a look at them and come up with their recommendations for the winners.
Now, Anne-Marie, earlier in the program, we talked with a couple of the Sisters of Mercy. It's their 150th anniversary. Tomorrow morning is when a group of nuns arrived in Sacramento. And as it happens, October 1857 is also the founding of Sacramento Library. What kind of library was it back then? Would it resemble the libraries of today?
No, it wouldn't. It was a very small collection of a few volumes, and actually it was limited to people who were willing to pay to join the library, not like today's free public library in our community. But that library, the Sacramento Library Association, really was the precursor to the Sacramento Public Library, and we're here today because a number of our very early residents decided that one of the things that was very important for their community was to have a library in it.
Indeed. Now, John, The Suspect, this year's One Book Sacramento novel, was your most recent book. It was published in hardback at the beginning of this year, correct?
Right, correct.
And it comes out in paperback early next year, just
right
before your next novel.
I know.
What is your next book?
My next novel is called Betrayal. And for those readers out there who may be listening and waiting for my next Dismas Hardy and Abe Glitzky book, that's going to be it. It's a little bit of a departure from the kind of book I've been writing in the past, because this book actually has a kind of a international theme. It starts in Iraq, and it concerns two men who knew each other over there and come back here to the States and get in some trouble.
Okay. And you've been busy this summer going to some writers' conferences,
it's
correct?
It's been really a great summer, Jeff. I went to the Maui Writers Conference, and that's the first time I've ever worked for, you know, maybe 9 days with a class of people.
Someone's got to do it, John.
Pardon?
Someone's got to do it.
Yeah, I know. Fantastic. So, and then I did the Mendocino Writers Conference, and then next month I'm going to be doing the Tamales Bay workshops through UC Davis.
Very nice.
It's great.
And Anne-Marie, any final thoughts from you about One Book Sacramento and also what you're doing in commemoration of the Sacramento Library's 150th anniversary?
Well, thanks for asking. I think One Book Sacramento, this is our third year with it, as you mentioned, has become a program that people look forward to. They want to know what the book is. And it's been a wonderful way to bring our community together around a reading opportunity. You know, really what the local library is about reading and learning and creating a sense of community. And so this is a key way that we do it. We've certainly wound all of those themes into our 150th anniversary. As I've mentioned, we have a big celebration the weekend of October 20th and 21st. But then in all of our branches also, we have programs that are going on throughout the month of October that really highlight a lot about the history of Sacramento and the 19th century. Lots of information available on the library website at saclibrary.org, and I'd encourage people to take a look at it and join us for some of these great events.
Well, thank you both very much. We've been talking about One Book Sacramento. It starts today. This year's book is The Suspect by John Lesqua, and my guests have been novelist John Lesqua and the director of Sacramento Public Library, Anne-Marie Gold. John, Anne-Marie, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you,
You're
Jeffrey.
Welcome.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, some entrepreneurs trying to make fast food more appealing to Orthodox Jews. Plus, rock band Radiohead is selling its new album directly from its website, and buyers set their own price. Those stories and the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer was Candice Mangouchet. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. play about Edgar Allan Poe is getting its world premiere in Nevada City. On the next Insight, you'll meet the local playwright behind this original piece. It offers a glimpse into Poe's work and personal life prior to his death in 1849. Plus, you'll hear a scene. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow at 2 on KXJZ.